The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
Hi, Brian here, the integrated dentist for UKHealthRadio.com. Last time I had the privilege of interviewing Stephen Lynn, and he talked about his new book, The Dental Diet. Since then, I've spent some time with Stephen, and he's the real deal. And what I'd like to do, and Stephen has agreed, to actually continue the discussion, because he's still got some vital facts that he can give out, which you then obviously can pick up and get know in more detail by buying his book. But Stephen, let's talk about some of the subject matter you covered when we had when I attended your seminar on Sunday.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brian. You know, this is such an exciting conversation. I really think we're really kind of tapping a nerve here, aren't we? That there's people want to know, you know, how food, you know, prevents disease in the mouth, but also all over the body.
That's right. And also, it was encouraging to see how many health professionals were so fascinated by your presentation and actually attended.
Yeah, that was a really interesting part of, we held the seminar in London, and, you know, a good proportion of the audience were dentists, dental hygienists, other health professionals. And so there was a big movement, and there were some experienced practitioners, but, you know, there was a lot of young practitioners there that are looking for the next answers, because really what we're seeing is that a lot of the problems that we're seeing in patients, we don't have answers for. And, you know, that's what science is all about. That's, you know, we really need to be looking for, you know, is what we're doing working, and, you know, how can we move forward? So it was a great discussion on, you know, a lot of the research and a lot of the papers we haven't really being integrated into our training, and, you know, how do we start doing that? How do we start understanding it? How do we start getting this to our patients?
I agree, and I think, I don't know what it's like in other parts of the world, such as, say, Australia or America, USA, but I know from my own personal experience, the amount of nutritional training that I receive, and I think my younger counterparts receive at an undergraduate level, is extremely low.
Exactly. This is a big problem, and, you know, we've more or less come forward and admitted now, you know, that, you know, look, medical and dental professions, you know, it's a very busy, hot, intense curriculum, and so, you know, the time that students have to learn the modules and the learning processes, it's limited. So, and we really have not included nutrition and, you know, kind of preventative processes into this. And so, you know, we've more or less acknowledged that. And so what we're seeing is that, you know, we do have a healthcare system that doesn't understand, how to prevent disease through nutrition. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that as such. You know, we've come a long way in terms of treating diseases and managing diseases. But that's, we're now moving into that next conversation. What's happened, I think, is in the last 20 years, we've had so much research come out that shows, a much deeper understanding of the body and how actually, healthcare professionals can be using food to both reverse but also prevent disease. And I think this is the conversation that's really popping up this year, that we're moving along from just reactionary, kind of disease-focused healthcare, and we're moving into a much more lifestyle and really understanding how nutrition and food can have positive impacts on people's lives.
I absolutely agree. And I think although it's banded around the term holistic, where, we have to look at all factors involved for how the body functions, is so important. And you very much sort of gave in your talk to us the fact that if you didn't have the right, say, developmental areas, that it then reflected on the anatomy of the jaws and then also function. So, this is a big step forward because, we always thought that, for example, that if you had a crowded mouth, this was just due to the fact that you had dad with big teeth and big jaws marrying mum with small teeth and small jaws and getting big teeth and small jaws. Well, you explained not only that this wasn't the truth, or it was only a part of the truth, but also how things could be remedied, which would increase the well-being of that children.
Yeah, this is a big one. I think, we've had such, such confusion around dietary guidelines and, how we eat for health. But that what we've really missed out on is, growth and development of kids and how we grow kids, to develop into adults that prevent chronic disease. Because we're in a chronic disease epidemic here and we really need to kind of have a look at this because, we're talking about healthcare systems being bankrupt by 2030. And I think really what we're seeing in the mouth is the precursor of all those conditions, the type 2 diabetes, obesity, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, everything that goes wrong in the mouth when a kid doesn't develop right dentally, that is the precursor for diseases moving on. And so if we don't understand how, nutrition and dietary inputs affect the mouth, then it just goes into a lifelong process of disease. And the biggest health epidemic on the planet I think we're facing today is that kids' jaws don't grow to fit teeth. And we know now, the evidence is there to show us that when we don't develop our upper and lower jaws, airways don't develop, we predispose ourselves to conditions like sleep apnea, which then increases our risk of heart attacks, high blood pressure, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, all of these things flow on, and it's all a problem with not developing properly. And so how we've not had this conversation is a little bit, it's a bit funny when you think about it, but we've come to think of braces and orthodontia as being normal. Well, it's not normal. We need to get back to a physiological norm where kids are developing properly, breathing properly. And there's an orthodontic model now where we can intervene. We don't just wait until a kid is 12 now until we put braces on. We need to make sure that they're checking that they're developing properly right from birth. And so this is all begins with food, and it's all a functional model where we have a much better understanding of how our inputs are affecting our health.
And I suppose really this needs to be literally sort of, brought into the educational model for the undergraduates, both medical and dental.
Yeah, there's two points there exactly that you brought up that is really, really important. One, that a lot of this science and a lot of this, the research and understanding of craniofacial growth for dental students isn't taught. So we don't learn that malocclusion is a problem with development. We learn how to classify it. We learn how to treat it. And dental students get, obviously, a very small scope on that. We need to completely rewrite that. That we need to understand that the growth of the jaws and face, intimately happening throughout a child's life, and that crooked teeth are a symptom of when we don't get those right growth signals. And so the signals are many: nutritional, tongue and breathing, oral function. All of this comes in. Now where we're just kind of painting out this model where we can intervene it. Now, on the other side of that is the oral systemic link. Now, doctors are completely clueless on how oral development, breathing, sleep apnea, you know, how that all connects to the mouth. You know, when they see a dental infection, they prescribe antibiotics and that's it. You know, but we need to have a collective conversation here. You know, there's no, we've been far too isolated, you know, in looking at the mouth and dental health, and it's been harmful for how we perceive and treat the oral cavity, because we can't, you can't have something happen to the mouth and not happen to the rest of the body. And it's time to move on from that. And so there is a new model. I think what we're seeing is that there is potentially going to be a bridging practitioner, which I think would be something like an oral systemic practitioner, that would be the bridge between a traditional dentist and a traditional doctor, and they would be the sleep and breathing and nutrition, you know, my functional therapy. They're trained across all of that, and then they can bridge those two professions to really kind of have a better conversation.
Yes, I agree. What was quite shocking for me, because in my book, which was 2010, there was a recent survey on children under five with tooth decay, which is a manifestation of all the things you've talked about, you know, the nutrition and also from preconceptual and during pregnancy, all having effect on these poor children. And you were saying to me, Stephen, that the figures for attending hospitals to have tooth extractions has now increased in the UK. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And the figures just came out a few weeks ago that kids going under for general anaesthesia in the UK to have their childhood dentition extracted because of rotten, decayed teeth has increased again this year. And it's been a steady increase for the last 5 years. And there, you know, there was a little bit of an uproar, you know, between, you know, blaming politicians and blaming, you know, access to, obviously, funding for the NHS. But, I mean, I think what this is a symptom of, it's a symptom of not understanding the core problem. We don't, you know, brushing and flossing and fluoride, you know, are very superficial approaches to tooth decay. Why don't we look at vitamin D? You know, there's vitamin D and the its deep processes with both mineral and calcium balance in the body, but also the immune system. It's an exact, you know, when we get tooth decay, you know, we know kids today, there's so many kids out there who are vitamin D deficient. The studies show that that puts them at higher risk of tooth decay. Why haven't we looked at this? And so, you know, that's one, you know, very superficial, well, very important, but it's one aspect of how diet can protect us against tooth decay. But then on the other side, we know now that there are bacteria protecting us from dental decay as well. So when you have an imbalanced oral microbiome, you know, that is puts us at risk of those pathogenic bacteria growing. And so that's another dietary input that we have research clearly showing us, you know, how to intervene in, yet we're not talking about. So there's a lot of ways here that we've gone wrong, and I think what this speaks of is that tooth decay really is one of the first things that happens in kids when we don't eat the right foods. And it's even going back to, for instance, vitamin D levels prenatally from the levels of their mother maternally, breastfeeding, so the breast milk levels of vitamin D and microbiome is passed on. Research shows that. So a vitamin D deficient mother will pass on vitamin D deficient milk to their child. And then so if we don't eat a diet up until, you know, 6, 7, 8 that is rich in vitamin D, then that's a recipe for tooth decay because the body can't manage its own minerals. You know, the teeth have an inner immune system that is controlled by the hormonal signals that vitamin D releases through the osteoimmune system. There are stem cells that are directed by this. We don't control it when we are vitamin D deficient. One really alarming thing that I saw come out this week in Australia, and there are some cases as well in the UK, is that we're now seeing an increase of kids having rickets. Now, we know what rickets is caused by, and it's extreme vitamin D deficiency. Now, tooth decay, my argument is that tooth decay is a little bit up the spectrum, and that when we don't have enough vitamin D, our body can't manage its hard structure. So why this hasn't been discussed when you've got 45,000 kids in the UK going into hospital to have rotten teeth extracted, I don't know. So I think, you know, we've got the societal signals there. We really need to kind of address this and move forward.
I know with the vitamin D, which obviously did create a lot of interest at the meeting, the fact is that now, I don't know what it's like in the USA but in Australia, but certainly medical practitioners are aware that that there is a likelihood that we have a quite a large proportion of the population that have got suboptimal levels of vitamin D. But you've actually also demonstrated, which I think is very impressive, the what I'll call the evidence-based research, which shows that there is a strong link between dental health and vitamin D levels. Now, because you've got this evidence-based research, again, it should be enough to be able to promote sort of healthcare situations where it's, you know, if I may say crudely, the right proportions are doled out. I mean, I remember going back 50, 60 years ago where we were doled out cod liver oil, you know, because it was just known to do us good, you know.
Exactly. I mean, that's such a great point, you know, and like this loss of this kind of, you know, traditional knowledge of how humans, it's been completely stripped out of what our modern life. And, you know, it's a matter of kind of recalibrating and going back. But, you know, at that meeting, you know, there was a practitioner that said, well, you know, I send my patients to my doctor and they don't even bother testing for vitamin D deficiency because they know they're deficient regardless. And this is how prevalent the problem is. And, you know, some of the studies even show that the calculations on the dosages and the blood levels we set public health measures for vitamin D, both intake and healthy blood levels were drastically understated. So what we're likely looking at is, you know, a population that is already deficient, but the levels may even be far more deficient than what we've previously decided what we need to manage our bones and teeth. And so there's one study that came out of Russia that showed that when you move people off their traditional diets, what they did is they measured the indigenous people that still lived on their the diets off the land, and then those living on the modern diet, and they measured their vitamin D levels. And those, as soon as they came off their traditional means, their vitamin D levels dropped. And so this is a dietary problem. And in the UK, you know, there is a chronic lack of sun, you know, throughout the majority of the year. So you have to be getting your vitamin D from your diet or supplementation. So this is a problem that we know is happening and we're just ignoring.
You also said as well that that you also explained the problems given various dietary, interest that people have. For example, you're saying that things like if somebody was eating meat, that there was an element that how the meat was reared. You also talked about what, say, vegans would need to do in terms of looking at things, not just, as you say, vitamin D, but also the other strong element that you brought up was the K2.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing that we absolutely have not been, well educated in, both health practitioners, but also, a public sense, is that vitamin K has a number of subsets of molecules that have different roles in the body. And so K1 is the one that we've known that is used for blood coagulation. But K2, called amenoquinone, has a couple of different molecules that do different things in the body. But they're crucial for working alongside vitamin D to mineralize bones and teeth. So when you don't have enough K2 in your body, you can have all the D you want, but your body can't activate the proteins to carry calcium into bones. And so this is, you know, so well understood that in Japan, the health ministry there approves vitamin K2 as a treatment for osteoporosis. Yeah, they say these people need vitamin K2 to increase their bone density, and the studies there show that there is a percentage increase when K2 levels or K2 intake is increased. And so this is something that we've not discussed again, and it is crucial for dental health. It's crucial for hormonal signals in the body. Both D and K2 direct growth hormone. They direct sex hormones. So we've had a big discussion this week with fertility experts. So we have huge problems today with infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, endometriosis. They are all issues with vitamin D and vitamin K2. Now, the problems we see in the mouth are tooth decay and crooked teeth because jaws don't grow, but the end stage problems are hormonal issues and infertility. And so it's all the same problem of not understanding how the body absorbs and uses these nutrients that grow bones and teeth.
Hello?
Oh, you got me there?
I just lost you for about the last sort of 10 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, so what I really try and get through in the dental diet and to my patients is that fat-soluble vitamins, if you don't think about them, then you're not getting enough, straight up. And so you can get yourself tested, but you really need to start eating a diet, which we go through in the book. You know, it's a 40-day program to reintroduce these nutrients to your diet. Because long-term, your food is the way to heal your body. You know, you can supplement to get you back on track, but you want to get yourself back to food because that's how we've always taken in these nutrients.
Well, I did notice that your dietary plan was really very comprehensive, and my question would be, and I'm really sort of playing devil's advocate, would it be that difficult for people to keep following it?
Well, yeah, you know what, you're right. There is an element, and it took me a long time to do, that dietary plan, was put together from a lot of notes from my practice and tips from my patients and stuff. But you're right, the food is a difficult topic today. And so sourcing, preparation, they are all issues in terms of how we are getting the right type of nutrients. Just going to a Tesco or just going to your local supermarket, you may not be able to get some of the foods, for instance, you need. So you've got to be repackaging. So there is a big issue with food. And make no mistake about it, that it's a problem at hand. But my argument, I hope, is that, when we understand how crucial and how powerful, good food is, that taking that little bit of extra time and maybe spending just that little bit more on good quality, well-sourced foods, you're going to prevent 7, 8, 9, 10x down the road in disease. And so let's make all the links to how we make ourselves sick and then understand that every meal is a potential way to prevent that.
I think you're absolutely right in the sense that there is an element of people actually looking to be what I would call they have to be themselves in terms of make critical decisions. I was only listening to Ty Bollinger, and he was saying that because his area of special interest has been cancer, that he says sometimes you have to make difficult choices. But it's a difference between having, like he said, food that he absolutely loves to have, but he knows that it's a choice between that and maintaining a good level of health and reducing risk of disease.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I've found too is that, when you kind of reintroduce yourself to the foods that your body actually want, you really don't have that connection to the junk and processed food. And, and just even recalibrating in a way, to see what's coming out of those packages and what you're really putting into your own and your child's mouth, I think that perspective change does help a lot. And you don't want to eat something that's going to give you digestive problems, give you allergies, that doesn't kind of feed those core processes that give you healthy jaws and teeth. So you're right, like we've got such problems with foods, we really need to recalibrate it all. I really think that the mouth and teeth are, you know, one of the most powerful messages for that. You know, it's right here. We can look straight in there and see, you know, what the results are. And, you know, everyone wants healthy teeth, and, you know, no one likes going to the dentist with disease. So we need to kind of have this broader conversation about how important it is.
I agree, and it's a bit like if I go back, say, 50, 60 years ago, that a medical practitioner, when you walked into the surgery, the first thing you were asked to do was to poke your tongue out.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's something that's been lost, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the tongue is such a great diagnostic tool for what's going on in the digestive system, which we know so many people have an issue with today. How that, you know, we weren't taught of any kind of diagnostic factors in terms of the tongue, you know, besides, you know, a few of the oral lesions that pop up, you know, like your lichen planus or geographic tongue, you know, and that's actually a point that I was hoping to dive into a bit more this year. There's so many diagnostic, you know, messages that we can get from the tongue.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that I always stand out from many years ago was, you know, a chronic B deficiency causing that so-called beefy tongue with deep furrows, deep red, you know. And again, I see it quite often, but, you know, we should be looking at sharing this information with our medical colleagues so that it's not a case of, well, that's not where I'm coming from. I don't really know what to suggest.
Yeah, exactly. And one study as well showed that, so for instance, oral lichen planus, which is that fluffy white lesion that you get on the cheeks and sometimes the tongue, the connection to gastric parietal cells. So actually when they supplemented with B12, they actually decreased the autoantibodies against parietal cells and decreased the lichen planus at the same time. So that's a great example of the oral systemic kind of connection at work. And, you know, it's simply good diagnosis in the mouth, you know, understanding how that connects to the body and using a nutrient-based healing process.
Well, you see, Stephen, these are the gems of wisdom. You see, I didn't know about the connection between B12 because, you know, oral lichen planus is extremely common. And when it's severe, it's a case of referring to a consultant who will, first of all, say, what's the cause? Stress. What's the treatment? Not really an awful lot. So, you know, you're just full of these gems of knowledge. Thank you.
Well, the other thing too with oral lichen is we have to remember that it's an autoimmune disease. And so we know autoimmune diseases come in groups. They don't come by themselves. And the core process that's happening is gut permeability. So intestinal permeability. We know that that's, you know, Alessio Fasano did so much research on this. A lot of it's been published over the last 10 years, but in 2012 especially, that, for instance, gluten intolerance and celiac disease is a problem with gut permeability, and you have to have that dysfunction there in order to have autoimmunity. So all of a sudden, if you see oral lichen planus in the mouth, you should really be thinking of gut health, intestinal permeability, and autoimmune conditions as a tribe, because autoimmune conditions don't come on their own. And so if we're exhibiting oral lichen planus in the mouth, you know, they might be moving down the road to conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, or, you know, even more serious conditions like multiple sclerosis. And so all of these are in this spectrum of not eating the right things, not understanding the digestive system as a fluids, you know, system that we actually interact with.
Yeah, and I mean, taking a holistic view, you could understand that the consultants are technically correct, because obviously if somebody is under a lot of stress, you know, their whole of everything from their salivary flow right the way through to the microbiome through the whole body will also be altered by the chemicals caused by stress. So, you know, it's just trying to put all these pieces together.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, we know that stress has a physiological impact on the body. You know, you look at the release of hormones and, you know, how it affects sleep. So there's no doubt that our lifestyles as a whole are affecting our health. And, you know, we really need to take a look at every single one.
That's right. Stephen, can I go back? Now, we were talking about food selections. Now, if we're looking at getting the K2 especially, you mentioned about those of us who are possibly still carnivorous. You were talking about the difference between the way that meat is grown and how you could then get the right, you know, a natural way of getting, say, K2.
Yeah, so there's two types of K2, so menaquinone 4, which is the animal source type, and menaquinone 7, which is actually bacterial source. And so there are actually probably up to 15 menaquinones, but the main two that we know are the MK4 and the MK7. So in terms of MK4, now, for example, in butter, in butter that comes from grass-raised cows. Now, grass-raised means they get that nice green, and it may even be the season that they eat the grass, because that green spring-growing grass has that deep green colour, which is actually the phylloquinone, which is created through the photosynthesis process. And so if they have that K1 in their diet, they K2 in their dairy and also in their meat as well. So if you have butter from non-grass-raised cows, you're likely getting no K2 in it, because there's no K1 initially in the cow's diet. So natural processes that will give access for the animals to nutrients then translate to both their meat and also their dairy products as well. So eggs, for instance, naturally raised chickens that see sunlight, they eat insects, they get the full spectrum of nutrients instead of just being fed in a cage. You know, we know that, for instance, that can change the nutrient availability of those eggs. So a lot of the eggs we get off supermarket shelves, unfortunately, will not have that K2 in them. Whereas if you find, you know, kind of naturally raised, organically raised chickens, you're going to get that K2 rich egg yolk. And a big one as well is organ meats, so liver from grass raised beef, lamb, chicken livers. This is a big source of these fat soluble vitamins that we don't get from other food sources.
So although it could be called organic, if it's not been grass raised, then you still could be looking at something that's not delivering the K1, K2.
Yeah, exactly. So so in Australia, for example, organic legally means that it is grass-raised. So it's a bit different. In the US, it doesn't. In the UK, it's a little bit between. So I think you guys have the grading system on the eggs and dairy where you see there's the classes. I can't remember exactly what those classes mean, but if you don't see, free range or naturally raised livestock, then it often means they will not be, and you will not have the nutrients in them as a result.
Although they still could be organic because they've been possibly fed on organic grains, of course. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So that may be. See, that's one of the ways that this really needs to kind of be standardised so that people know what they're getting. One thing I'd suggest is, go to your local farmers market, go to your local butcher. Go to where your vegetables are raised. Find out how your food's being raised and produced. There is a lot of options out there, and you do going to that little bit of effort can help to find that, to get that more nutrient dense food.
And fortunately, in the UK, there has been quite a resurgence in farmers' markets. We are sort of, I suppose, catching up compared to, say, I know that there's been quite a big resurgence in the USA, but it is following over here as well.
Well, it's still an accessing, in most of, in certain parts of, for instance, cities, it is a bit harder than others, but there is actually quite a good food movement going on in the UK where people are getting back to that well-sourced, nutrient-dense food supplies. So, it's happening. You might have to look around a bit, but I think, the benefits, far outweigh both the inconvenience and the cost.
Absolutely. Stephen, the other thing which is becoming increasingly more common, and I think there's well over 1.6 million people in the country, are now vegans. Now, if we're looking at the D3K2, Where would they source that, or would they need to be taking supplements?
Yeah, so for what we need to understand is that the fat-soluble vitamins go through an activation process to their most bioactive forms. And so these bioactive forms of A, D, and K2 are, for the most part, come from animal sources. So if you're not eating animal products, and that includes eggs and dairy or meat, you cannot, by definition, get these bioactive forms. And so there will be some conversion, for instance, of beta-carotenes, which will convert to retinol, which is the active form of vitamin A. So from vegetables, you can get some of that, but people are genetically different, and the amount of conversion isn't well known, and it actually looks like it's quite low. You know, it might be down between the 15 and 25%, actually, how much you're converting. And same goes for D2, which is found in mushrooms. Now, that actually competes with D3. So eating vegetarian vegan sources of vegan sources of vitamin D2 may actually be prevent you from increasing the active form of vitamin D in your blood. And then K2 is the same. K2 has a certain amount of vitamin K1 that will be converted to MK4, and then you've also got the bacterially produced MK7. Now, both K1 and MK7 K2 are converted in the liver to MK4 vitamin K2. And so when you eat them from a food source, your body distributes them differently, and it seems that you need to get a certain amount of each of them so that your body can both use up the active form and then convert what it needs in the liver. So if you are vegan, just understanding these nutrient systems, I would suggest supplementing vitamin D, or at least testing your vitamin D. If you're getting lots of sun, great. Vitamin A and vitamin K2 you might need to supplement as well, because you can't get them from vegan sources. So that's just a straight up, physiological thing that humans, we've kind of evolved. That's how our digestive system works. You know, I would suggest testing your levels, seeing where you're at, and you can supplement as an option.
Well, thanks for that advice, Steve, because I think there'll be a lot of listeners who often find that when there's a certain amount of confusion, and this can be from vested interests, that they virtually just throw their hands up and just say, oh, well, I might as well just carry on my, frankly, possibly not as healthy eating habits as they should, simply because there's too many, smoke screens that actually do not give clear, precise, and also, what you're talking about is evidence-based research, and also how it is actually assimilated in the body. Because in theory, it's different from just saying, you have a particular chemical and saying that by taking it, it will actually give you what you want. It's far more, unfortunately, complex than that.
Far more complex. Actually, and just to kind of open the rabbit hole, but so folic acid supplements is a great example of that, in that folic acid is a synthetic supplement that we give prenatally, but many people, up to 50% of the population, do not convert folic acid to its active form, which is methylfolate and folinic acid. And so this is something that nearly every pregnant woman is being advised to take folic acid during pregnancy, yet many people aren't converting it. So there's a lot of misconceptions out there about the both food sources and supplements that actually we do give benefits. So we really need to break down a lot of the misconceptions and start from scratch.
Well, I suppose getting back almost to where we came in on, we are looking at needing our public to be advised by our both dental practitioners, but I suppose more importantly medical practitioners, so that there is clear advice which especially our medical colleagues can give out, which is basically, I won't say unequivocal, but at least in fact, there's clear guidances. Because if you're just a member of the public without any knowledge, it must be extremely, extremely difficult to not be completely confused by the whole area of frankly, good nutrition in what is a very difficult environment in the Western, Western world, really.
Absolutely, just to put some perspective on that, I can tell you that health practitioners are confused and scared and unsure of what to do as well. And I see a lot of specialists and both medical and dental practitioners with poor gum disease and serious chronic diseases because they haven't been eating right. And so we've just completely got things wrong. It's time to recalibrate and have a very sensible, simple discussion on how to eat properly.
And would you tend to agree that you see articles that are put out often in sort of quasi-medical language or what have you, where they say all we need is a balanced diet, that in a Western world, we just cannot get that. There is no such thing if you're just having what is causing this myriad of various disease processes, of which tooth decay possibly is the most common.
Yeah, well, that this is exactly, we've been talking about a balanced diet for a long time now, and that really doesn't, it doesn't at least, elucidate for everyday people, families and someone looking to, eat well to prevent disease, what exactly they eat. And, we've come around on some things like sugar, processed foods, there's still, we've got some big problems with vegetable oils in the food supply, white flour, there's so many issues there. And the idea of balance just doesn't help people understand, what they need to eat.
I agree, and I think the researches and your book will certainly help people. It may be that people have to literally become motivated because of their own personal circumstances with possibly what I would call avoidable diseases. And my big theme has been that virtually all dental diseases are in fact preventable and stroke avoidable.
Yeah, I love that, Brian. It's so important for people. There is really a sense of hopelessness when people have dental disease, and I just think that we need to get that message out that you're ultimately in control of how your body, responds to its environment, and your teeth and jaws are one of the best signs of that. So, understanding how to eat is a powerful way, to put yourself on the road to lifelong health.
Stephen, it's been a huge privilege to speak to you again, and I'd like to feel that we keep in touch via our own personal connections, but also that any time you feel that you could add to our listeners by giving them advice, then please up your UK Health Radio will always be open to your very learned and wise researches and how you're proactively trying to get that into place. So, Stephen, I thank you sincerely for coming and speaking to me again.
Thanks, Brian. Such a pleasure. And thank you again for all the work you've done for so long. And, I really enjoy these conversations, and I look forward to more in the future.
Thank you. Really a privilege. Thank you, Stephen.
I can see clearly.